Can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see?
Not here on the Green Front. We see and hear all, sometimes too much for those of us who lose sleep over rising sea levels and temperatures and melting heat records and all that. Welcome to the Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Very excited about today's show. Have some topics and guests I think you're not going to want to miss. First up, we'll speak to Dr. Jonathan Kumi. He is a Stanford professor. His expertise is, well, pretty wide, actually, but energy efficiency, computer technology, and he actually has some encouraging news about efficiency and battery life actually improving going forward. That's the first segment. And then second up, we'll be talking about BPA. You've heard a lot about it, but what is the link to breast cancer? We'll speak with Janet Noodleman. She is with the Breast Cancer Fund, and find out the latest research and also about a campaign against Campbell's Soups, which apparently still has BPA in their cans. Want to stay away from that in the meantime. And last but not least, we'll get the latest on a very successful protest put forward by a group that I've just learned about. They're fairly new, and it's Forecast the Facts. It's trying to hold meteorologists accountable for connecting the dots between climate change and extreme weather events. We'll speak to the campaign director there. They just delivered a signature petition with some 10,000 people signing, saying that Discovery Channel has sidestep the issue of climate change in its just finished series called Frozen Planet. We'll find out more about that from Daniel Swain. First up, Dr. John Kumi, thanks for joining me on the Green Front.
Hi, happy to be here.
Just want to give a little bit of your bio just to establish your one smart dude here. John Kumi is a consulting professor at Stanford University, has held visiting professorships at places like Yale and also UC Berkeley, also Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, spent some time there leading their energy efficiency program, looking at technology and how to improve its efficiency. That is so important in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, as we're all increasingly plugged into ever more gadgets. Dr. Kumi also has advanced degrees from UC Berkeley and Harvard, and he has written 8 books. The latest is Cold Cash, Cool Climate, Science-Based Advice for Ecological Entrepreneurs. I could go on. Your bio goes a page long and is very impressive, but I want to jump right in because we only have you for about 15, 20 minutes and want to tap into your wisdom. And let's start with the good news. You say that even though some of us are concerned that, you know, it seems like everything is needing to be charged at night, just in my house alone, between the laptops, the telephones, and, you know, what gadgets, the iPads, I worry, you know, those of us who know that that is coal-fired power plants pumping away, charging all our gadgets. You say, though, the good news is that we are becoming more efficient, and that is happening at a pretty rapid rate. Probably doesn't mean we, you know, should sleep at night, not worried about climate change, but tell us what the latest research is showing.
So everyone knows about Moore's Law. Back in 1965, Gordon Moore of Intel looked at how the density of chips was changing over time. By density, we mean the number of components, transistors, say, you can fit on a chip. What he found was that that chip density was doubling about every year or so. In 1975, he revisited that analysis, and he found that the chip density was then doubling about every couple of years. And that trend has held more or less true for the last 30 or more years. Now, at the same time, as you increase chip density, you improve the performance of chips. And because we've gotten clever with software and done some other smart things, the improvement in performance has actually been even more rapid than in chip density. So we've doubled performance of computers in the microprocessor age by doubling about every year and a half. So that's a pretty rapid rate of increase, and that's about a factor of 100-fold improvement in performance every 10 years. What most folks don't know is that the energy efficiency of computing has also doubled every year and a half, and that trend actually began at the beginning of the computer age in the 1940s. So basically the smartphones and the laptops, these were an inevitable result of this long-term trend in the energy efficiency of computing. And what it has allowed us to do is, at a given level of computing performance, we're able to, over a decade, reduce the amount of battery we need to do it by a factor of 100. And that means many more mobile sensors and controls and smartphones and laptops. And that means that we're going to get a whole lot more clever about how we apply this technology to better meet energy service demands with the minimum amount of energy use.
Mm. And I have not seen your book yet, Cold Cash, Cool Climate, but is part of your message that we need to invest up front in a better tomorrow as far as reducing greenhouse gas emissions and creating building technology and equipment that's really going to make the biggest difference fastest?
So I think listeners to your show are already familiar with the arguments about climate science and the fix we find ourselves in, so I won't repeat those here. The point I want to emphasize that most folks don't know is that the solution is not just better technology. The solution also involves ways to help people change their behavior and institutions to transform themselves to become much more efficient in the way they use resources. So let me give you an example. One thing that occurs in data centers where I do a lot of research work is that you have a lot of inefficiencies. Very surprising to people because these are high-tech facilities and very important to the economy. But what you find is that in many data centers, the folks who buy the computing equipment have a different budget than the folks who actually have to pay for the energy bill and buy the cooling equipment and the power supply equipment to keep those servers running. So the fact that they have a different budget is an institutional failure, and it leads to inefficiency because the IT folks buying the computers, they don't care one whit for efficiency, and the savings don't accrue to them. And so changing the way institutions are structured can help remove some of these institutional failures and lead to a much more efficient outcome. In this case, it would mean having the data center have one person in charge of the whole enterprise, have one budget for that whole thing, and have every person who proposes something to change within that facility have to look at the total cost of what they're doing instead of just the cost to their budget. So the energy and climate problem is not just a problem of technology. It's a problem of changing our behaviors, changing our institutions to become a whole lot more efficient in the way we use resources and the way that we wrest value from the universe.
So it sounds like you're not of the school that says, smaller government at any cost, that sometimes it makes sense for the government to take a leadership role. You mentioned in a blog post that, like, the Department of Motor Vehicles here in California, since you're in Silicon Valley, really revamped their operations and are saving a lot of, aggravation on the part of customers, but also resources as well. Sometimes it does require that we look anew at sort of the status quo.
Yeah, I think on your first point, the idea of less government always being better is just false on the face of it. Sometimes we need more government. If you find lead in children's toys or you have a river that catches on fire or you have E. coli in your food, you want regulation to make sure that those problems are dealt with. So you can't, there's no other way to do that, right? In my view, more government is not better. Less government is not better. Only better government is better. So that's the first point. Now, there are many different ways that we can help accomplish our goals in an efficient manner, and we need to have government that is effective at doing that. The example you cited is one where we're getting more or less the same government, but they've been able to do it better. Certainly, there are burdensome regulations. We should get rid of those. But at the end of the day, we need to make sure that for the problems that require government intervention, that we're getting our money's worth and we're making sure that we're not forcing external costs onto the rest of the economy. By external costs, I mean costs that are not paid for in the market transactions. An example is the cost of coal. People say, well, the cost of generating coal-fired electricity is very low and wind power can't compete with that. That's not always true, even when looking just at the market cost. But if you look at the external costs of coal-fired power, as two studies in 2011 do, you find that those costs, even putting aside the climate change risks, even the cost of mountaintop mining, the cost of air pollution, the cost of toxic metals like mercury that come from the emissions of those power plants, those costs are 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour in the most conservative case. So that makes that plus the cost of coal-fired electricity is higher than the cost of wind. So coal-fired electricity, if you count all the costs from society's perspective, is very, very expensive. So you need to track those costs, and the only way you can internalize those costs is some kind of government action.
Now, one of the things I like about your approach is you really quantify all this, and we really need to understand what we're dealing with from a civil, environmental and engineering. You are, I should say, a professor of civil and environmental engineering, so you really are good at quantifying what we're up against, and that's really key. One of the numbers that I most like to start with when I am talking to people who don't quite understand the threat of climate change is 350, of course, that is parts per million and the safe level that climate scientists say we must not exceed, and yet we are up at around 393 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Why are numbers so important in talking to people about, you know, where we are, where we need to go?
So first off, I should say that predicting the future is hard, and so people who say we will hit some level of greenhouse gas concentrations in a given year, there's no way to predict that that will happen. But it is important to have goals, and what the people who have advocated for 350 parts per million have done is they've looked at the concentrations of greenhouse gases compared to where they have gone in the industrial era. They look at the pre-industrial concentrations and said, in order to keep the climate from changing into a potentially dangerous regime, that we need to drastically reduce our emissions and then develop technologies that will allow us to derive energy services using vastly less energy and emitting much less carbon. So I think it's important, even though we can't really predict if we can get to 350 or 360, we don't really know until we try. People who claim they can predict the future, I think, in general, are exhibiting a hubris that will eventually lead to trouble. So the important thing to remember is having an ambitious goal, trying to meet it, an ambitious goal that's based on the best science that we know of, I think is the only way to conduct our affairs. And if we fail to meet that goal because it's too difficult, then at least we will have tried. But if we lower our sights and say, well, we can't possibly do anything like that, then we're sure to fail. So usually when people put their minds to solving problems, we figure out things that we can't even conceive of now. So I'm a technological optimist in the sense that the history shows the level of innovation is possible when the whole society bands together to focus on accomplishing a specific goal.
And yet we should not be complacent and think that technology will save us in the end, and we need not worry. You are saying that there needs to be individual action. And also there's a role for entrepreneurs, and you're in the heart of Silicon Valley. Are you seeing more business types at Stanford becoming interested in ecological entrepreneurship or ecopreneurship?
Yeah, you're starting to see people developing companies that reduce emissions and also make a profit. And the reason why they're able to do that is because there's a lot of inefficiency in the way we currently generate value. And that inefficiency comes from difficult problems that relate to, like, that institutional problem that I talked about in the data center. Sometimes it relates to individuals' inability to make informed choices. They don't have the information that they need. There's many different sources of such inefficiency, but the fact that this inefficiency exists gives hope to people who are trying to both reduce emissions and make a profit at the same time.
And we just have a couple minutes left. Again, I want to tap into your, wide wisdom here. There's so many areas, directions we could go in. But you did mention in one of your recent blog posts that ideology, blind ideology especially, is neither liberal nor conservative, but just plain dumb. How is clinging to ideology going to really slow us in the effort to turn climate change around?
So ideology is actually helpful in a certain context. The world is complicated, and we use ideology as a kind of simplifying filter. The problem comes when ideology gets in the way of recognizing reality. And in the case of climate, the reality is that the Earth is warming, and humans are primarily responsible for that. And if we continue on the path that we are on, we will push the Earth well outside the comfortable range in which humanity evolved, well outside. And what we're talking about, instead of keeping the temperatures at 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, which is the agreed-to target of the G8 and some other countries, we're talking about 5 degrees Celsius warming by 2100. So that's about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Think about your average temperature in the summer going up 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Think about what your summer would be like and what will happen to the creatures who are used to a certain climate range, what will happen to agriculture, what will happen to sea levels, which are rising faster than we ever expected. There's a whole series of potential consequences. The Earth has not been warmer than 2 degrees Celsius in the last 2 million years. But we're talking about pushing it to 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial time.
Nothing cool about that.
Nothing cool about that.
Thank you. We're going to have you back. You're just a wonderful resource. I'm so glad that I've discovered you, and I look forward to reading your book, Dr. John Kumi. The book is Cold Cash, Cool Climate, Science-Based Advice for Ecological Entrepreneurs. Your website, is it your name, I presume? People want to find out more?
Kumi.com, K-O-O-M-E-Y.com.
Wonderful. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back. Actually, we're going to go straight, I believe, to our next interview. No, we're going to take a quick spot break. We'll be back. I'm going to be talking about, hopefully, BPA and breast cancer. In our last segment, we'll go back to my favorite subject, my obsession, and that's climate change, in the form of a very successful petition drive against my other favorite subject area, and that's mainstream media not getting it, not quite connecting the dots. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. Be right back.